welcome to the Andy Staples Show. And it's been a while since we have answered your question, so let's do a Dear Andy episode. I brought in my friend Ari Wasserman. He's here to probably piss you off, but hey, listen, Ari, we all have our talents.
We haven't said the word Michigan on this podcast in like 6 months. I'm starting to worry about us a little bit, you know?
I don't know that we're going to say it on this one either.
I don't think we are.
Hey, listen, I wrote a column in praise of Michigan for actually negotiating a fair market contract that reflected the coach's value in the marketplace. So, hey, we're on the Michigan folks' good side. I don't know how happy they are with Jim Harbaugh back, but at least they're not paying too much for him. So that's the joy there.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that you don't see very often in the coaching ranks, and good for them, especially during a year where buyouts aren't supposed to be as easy as they've been at other places, too, with COVID and everything. So it'll be interesting to see with an incentive-based contract and, you know, the ability to hire some new guys. They hired Mike Hart as a running back coach this week or last week. That's an interesting situation there. I'm looking forward to tracking it.
It will be interesting, but here's another one, and we'll start with our first question. It comes from Steven, Los Angeles. This is a good one. Looking at the last decade plus, it's occurred to me that two conditions are necessary to win a national title. One, a roster with at least 50% four or five-star players, and two, either A, elite, not just very good, QB, or to B, Alabama, who recruit and develop talent at such a ridiculous level that they can skip the whole elite QB thing, though they sometimes have that too. Given that, am I crazy for thinking that Notre Dame could actually win a title if and only if they land that elite QB they haven't had during Brian Kelly's tenure? They've had some very good quarterbacks this past decade, but never a generational talent like Lawrence, Newton, Burrow, etc. And I think that's a really interesting question because you and I have talked a lot about Notre Dame and the ceiling and what they can do differently. And I got to say, I think Steve listens to you quite a bit, Ari, because this certainly sounds like you. I thought you planted this question.
I wish I did. But it's good to read questions that reflect reality. And I think a lot of times, through no fault of their own, but fans don't view reality the same way. They view it through the prism of their team. And it's hard to, you know, sit back and really evaluate this. But I've got two words for you. Tyler Buchner. I mean, they just signed a top 65 player at the quarterback position out of La Jolla, California, which is the most Notre Dame thing on earth. And I think that it's possible that they might have found their guy, and this is how you have to do it. Now, after the national championship game last Monday, it just gives you another appreciation of just how good Alabama is and can be. And part of the reason they were what they were is because they had a handful of bona fide NFL players decide to inexplicably come back all at the same time to create that monster of a team. But it's just the way that these teams are built. And I give Notre Dame and Brian Kelly a lot of credit. I mean, they were the eighth most talented team in college football this year, and they played Alabama tougher than anybody. I mean, outside of maybe Florida and Ole Miss. And, you know, when you look at it, though, and you compare, we give how many points credit do we give for elite level quarterback hitting? It's three or four players, but if you compare Alabama's roster directly to Notre Dame's, Alabama's got 12 five-star prospects last year and 58 four-stars. Notre Dame has 2 5-stars and 44 four-stars, and that's literally 20 or 25 players better. And when you're talking about an 85-person player scholarship total, that is a significant difference. And, you know, Notre Dame, I think you could make the argument, got more out of their team than anybody got out of their team this year, outside, of course, Alabama, who won the national title. But, you know, that's true. And I think that the way that we view generational quarterbacks, the word generational now is being thrown around a little bit because generational means like once every 10 years. And like, who do you think was the last true generational talent? Like Trevor Lawrence?
Cam Newton.
Cam Newton.
Because he played with essentially a ham sandwich on offense and won the national title. Like the rest of that Auburn offense, the other 10 starters, do you know how many NFL starts they combined
for? I could probably guess.
What is it?
Zero.
One. One guy started one game. It's crazy. So, I mean, that's the thing. That's how good Cam was. We're not going to see that very often.
But listen, do you think Trevor Lawrence is a generational quarterback?
I think he probably is.
Do you think Justin Fields is?
I don't know.
I mean, the fact that it's even a discussion, I just think there's with these quarterback camps and these Elite 11 players, quarterbacks in general across the board are better and more ready than they used to be. And I think that it's important. I don't think you can win a national championship without an elite quarterback, but I don't think you have to have Cam Newton. You just have to have a really, really good one. And I think Ian Book played really well this year. I don't know if I would put him in the same galaxy as a guy like Trevor Lawrence, but
I think Ian Book is proof that they can develop a quarterback. I mean, Ian Book so outshone his recruiting ranking. And look, his skill set is good, but it's probably not, if you ask an NFL talent evaluator, they're going to tell you it's not the same thing as, you know, some of these other quarterbacks, or even like a Mac Jones, who was a three-star quarterback who may have just been under-evaluated as a recruit. But they can develop him at Notre Dame. And I do think in a one game, like we mentioned the gap between Notre Dame and Alabama, or the gap between Notre Dame and Clemson. In a one game scenario, if you have that quarterback, you got a shot.
Yeah, absolutely. And like Notre Dame too just signed the third ranked dual threat quarterback in America, and the fourth best player in California, and the a legit potential five-star quarterback. So, you know, you do this, and like some other schools are signing three or four players like that in a two-year, three-year cycle, and they have more of an opportunity to hit. Like Clemson is losing Trevor Lawrence, and we all know what's coming down the pike there. You know, and Ohio State, another team that was in the playoff, has the number one overall player in the country in 2022 committed as we speak, and has three other top 100 caliber quarterbacks going to be on the roster next year to replace him. So the more you have, the more likely you are to find that guy. But I think Notre Dame's biggest issue might just be the lack of skill that they have across the board, not against 85 or 90% of the rest of the sport, but when compared directly to the monsters of the sport. And I think that there's a chance for them to, you know, still improve by recruiting at a higher level. And I understand that Notre Dame views their situation as kind of an uphill battle. The idea of being a private Catholic school with crazy high academic standards is certainly an issue. But when you're talking about classes that have 20 or 25 players in it a year, they have an in at every private Catholic high school in America. They're little embassies. I wrote a story about this years ago, and that's an advantage. So I don't think that Notre Dame has hit its ceiling from a recruiting standpoint. And when you look at the 2021 class, there's no team in America that has been hurt probably more from the pandemic than Notre Dame, because what does Notre Dame rely on? They are the most national team that there is. And Indiana, the state, doesn't have a lot of talent. And they still finish with the number nine overall class. The problem is number nine in the rankings is a great ranking, but it's not good enough to win a national title. So when you add the fact that they, you know, were the 10th most talented team or whatever in this year's season, and they still made it to the playoff and still, for the most part, didn't get embarrassed by Alabama. They seem to be on the cusp of something, but I do think that there is like an overdrive mode that they can go into in the next 2 or 3 years to build off of that playoff appearance to maybe get into the number 5 or 6 range, which isn't, I don't think, an unreasonable ask. Plus, if you combine that with an elite quarterback, it doesn't have to be a generational Cam Newton quarterback, but an elite one, they can potentially win the college football playoff. And Alabama was maybe the best team in the history of the sport this year, or maybe LSU last year, but those aren't, that's Alabama at its peak. Alabama isn't at its peak every year. So if you hit the right
like
window.
The 2017 Alabama, let's say Notre Dame, a team like this year's Notre Dame team, had played the 2017 Alabama team that started Jalen Hurts before they switched to Tua Tagovailoa. That's a pretty good game.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
That's a pretty competitive game. So I do think they're closer than people think. And I also think on the quarterback front, the way the transfers are going to work for now, Notre Dame's a little bit different. It's hard to transfer into Notre Dame. Yeah. They take grad transfers more. But let's look at Joe Burrow's situation. Joe Burrow was not Joe Burrow until really his second year starting at LSU. He was a good quarterback. He pushed Dwayne Haskins in that quarterback competition. And I know people think that the Ohio State coaching staff was not telling the truth when they said it was a tough choice. No, it was a tough choice. And Burrow didn't really develop into that guy. So again, quarterback recruiting is a crapshoot. You may find a grad transfer. You may find a guy who got squeezed out in a weird situation who becomes that guy.
Notre Dame, too, is a great opportunity. I feel like being a quarterback at Notre Dame is great. It's not a tough sell. Now, they haven't produced NFL talent at that level the way that some of these other programs have. And like if Georgia gets on their horse and Vandegrift, the five-star prospect, hits there, then, you know, Georgia's a nice place. But Ohio State, Alabama, Clemson, now LSU to the same extent, Oklahoma more so than anybody. These are the places.
If Lincoln Riley says, come play for me, you go play for him.
Yeah, exactly, at the quarterback position especially. And they've turned – but, you know, the thing that I admire about Oklahoma is – they turned success with transfers into success in recruiting the position, because the genesis of Oklahoma's ability to get the Baker Mayfields and the Kyler Murrays and the Jalen Hurts, they're all transfers. But since they all had success there, the Spencer Rattlers and the Caleb Williams are coming out of high school now. So like what they've done is use the transfer portal, to your point, to build a desirable place. But the key element to all that is development. And I think that Notre Dame can say that they developed Ian Book to be the best Ian Book could be. And I think that's an attractive sales position. So if Buckner hits,
absolutely,
and Buckner is what we think he is, and some, you know, recruiting analysts on the West Coast think he's the best player on the West Coast. And when you're in the top 65, everybody has a claim to that. But I think Notre Dame could potentially be on the cusp of really taking that next step that their fans have been waiting for them to take.
Let me throw one more thing at you. You've got the NIL stuff, the name, image, and likeness stuff, where guys are going to be able to make their own deals starting this school year. And I know that the NCAA delayed the vote on that, but it's going to happen because the Florida law takes effect on July 1st. So they're going to have to make some rules. And wouldn't quarterback at Notre Dame be a very attractive proposition with the ability to make side deals?
Yeah, no, I know. I being the face of a program, like what programs would you want to be the face of? I mean, probably the five that are recruiting at the highest level, but Notre Dame is the first team that would come to mind just from a brand standpoint, for sure. I think, you know, some people might view certain places as hopeless, and I don't think Notre Dame is hopeless at all. I think that they have the resources, and Brian Kelly did a heck of a job this year, and in the right year with the right recruiting classes, they might actually have a chance. But what I'd really like to see out of Notre Dame before I start to take them as seriously as I would in Alabama or a Clemson is to see a top five class that's just legit. And like, we haven't seen that in the last few years. And once they start getting in, going from like 10 to 9 to like 5 and 6 or maybe 4, 5 and 6, then you might put yourself in a position to do something like that. Like Oregon jumped up to 6, USC, you know, bounced back 8, A&M is 7. I mean, it's the same usual suspects in the top four in the 2021, Bama, Ohio State, Georgia, and Clemson, and LSU's 5. But, you know, there's some new faces that are, you know, recruiting a little bit better. North Carolina is recruiting better. Miami has recruited better. Michigan is in the top 15. You know, there is a window there to really hit it. But the problem with the sport in general is, what does a team have to do, or a program or a coach have to do, to eclipse what Alabama, Ohio State, Georgia, and Clemson are doing? And that, I think, is the hardest jump to make. It's harder to go from 5 or 6 to 1 or 2 than it is to go from 30 to 15.
We'll be right back after these words.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep. You heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Let's go with a slightly tougher question. This is from Charlie. What has to happen for the Pac-12 to be relevant again? There's a lot to unpack here.
Yeah. Well, how about you just let me handle the recruiting stuff first, and then I'll let you take it.
Knock it out.
That's
the most important stuff.
In the 2020 class, and then I'll let this stat will be updated once we know where JT Tuimoloau ends up in 2021. But in the 2020 class, which is the class that signed last December, 9 of the consensus top 30 players in the country were in the geographical footprint of the Pac-12, including Nevada. And only 3 of those players went to Pac-12 schools. So roughly 30% of the most truly elite West Coast talent in the 2020 class have left to go play elsewhere. That
I mean 70%.
Is, yeah, 70% left, 30% stayed. That is inexcusable. And two of the three went to Oregon and USC for obvious reasons. Now, step one to being nationally relevant and competitive in the country is to recruit better, you know? And right now, even if you take USC and Oregon out of the mix, which teams on the Pac-12 are recruiting at a high enough clip for you to ever consider that they be there? Utah's a nice story. Washington's a nice story. They have teams that are solid year in and year out. But taking Washington for instance here, Andy, the state of Washington, and specifically the Seattle area where UW is located, had three top 10 players in the state or in the country in that one city. That was a huge opportunity for Jimmy Lake. And one of them is committed to Ohio State or signed with Ohio State. That's Emeka Egbuka, the five-star receiver. And JT Tuimoloau is the number two player behind only Corey Foreman, and it seems like he's going to leave the Pac-12 footprint. And if that happens, then you have another instance of Washington having a window of an opportunity to potentially build the foundation of a national championship caliber team, and now they're going to play at the Blue Bloods that everybody knows. And until that happens, you don't have a shot. Now, I will say in 2021, Oregon recruited its ass off. They have 21 commitments. They're the number six class in the country behind the Blue Bloods. And they have three players in the top 40, four in the top 53, and like 9 or 10 in the top 150. So that is an elite level class. And Mario Cristobal is set up for Oregon to being really good. And USC is number 8, and they signed the number one player in the class just now, and they have two elite level quarterbacks signed, one of which is Jackson Dart, who was a late riser. So you have some hope for the flagship programs of the conference, but the problem is that after the top two, and maybe Washington at three, who, like I said, had a missed opportunity, they just don't have the depth or the teams to compete at a national level until they recruit better in their own footprint. And the fact that LA and California is in that footprint, it needs to be capitalized on, and it just simply hasn't been in the past.
Well, and as you've written and I've written, the Arizona schools need to do a better job with their own backyard. I mean, the Phoenix area produces tons of good quarterbacks, but the best Phoenix area quarterback plays at USC. Now, he's in the Pac-12, but he should be at Arizona State or Arizona.
Yeah.
And you guys blew it by not recruiting Keaton Slovis. So,
and you went to Phoenix and wrote a story about it. There are a ton of them that left the Pac-12. Yeah,
Brock Purdy should be playing in the Pac-12.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no excuse for that.
Yeah.
You guys blew that. So, you know, the other piece of it is sort of administrative, and we can bag on Larry Scott a lot, I'm sure. But that's not the missteps with the Pac-12 network, all that stuff. That doesn't keep them from being relevant on the national football scene. That's not it. They need to win more. They need to make the playoff. Now, here's where Larry Scott screwed up. He had a platform and was in a position to help his league make the playoff. The second they got left out for a second consecutive year, Larry Scott should have been in every other commissioner's ear saying, we got to expand this thing. We got to go to eight. Got to get the champs of the Power Five leagues. And guess who he probably would have gotten a sympathetic ear from? The Big 12, which has had teams left out, and the Big 10, which had its champ left out in 2016. Now, Ohio State got in, but Penn State was left out. Ohio State was left out in 2017 as the Big Ten champ. Ohio State was left out in 2018 as the Big Ten champ. So you would have found sympathy within the Power Five. The Group of Five absolutely would have been on board with that because it would have probably created a system where the highest ranked Group of Five champ makes it. And Larry Scott didn't even think to ask until this year, and he didn't ask until he was asked about it. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, you know, and the thing too is that I think a lot of the college football problems seem to be solved by expanding, right? I mean, teams that are competing in the playoff at a higher level.
You have to think about it like it is a business. It is a nationwide enterprise, college football. And it's, you know, you've got competitors that live in different states, but it's a nationwide enterprise and it's healthier and makes more money if everybody's engaged. So you may be looking at the playoff as a play, you know, trying to find the best team. That's not what it really is. It is an opportunity to create games that the nation wants to see. And if you leave a bunch of the nation out, that's not good for your business.
If the winner of the Pac-12 championship game is playing for a spot in the playoff, everybody's watching it because it sets up the next games. It's that simple. And I also wonder, too, that if you were to expand the playoff, then teams, even group of five teams, for instance, I wrote a story about SMU this year trying to recruit the Dallas area very well, and they got a top 105 or 110 quarterback from Dallas to commit to SMU. And it's like if SMU were able to sell the fact that the group of five has a playoff spot or an at-large spot, then maybe the Savion Birds of the world who ended up at a powerhouse instead of the group of five local team might have thought about, hey, I can actually win a national championship or compete for one.
Let me throw this at you, because if let's say UCF is competing against Purdue and Michigan State and NC State for a quarterback, who has a better chance of making the playoff if the top-ranked group of five team makes the playoff?
Right.
UCF does better than those schools. So that might help tilt the balance a little bit too. And isn't that that's what everybody's complaining about. Everybody's complaining the best players go to the same schools. Well, these are the things that help tilt the balance. Now, I do agree with Joshua Perry, the former Ohio State linebacker, when he says, look, winning championships is great. It's not the determining factor. The determining factor is, do you create NFL players?
That's true.
And that's sort of on those individual schools to do that themselves. And you know, they can show, if they can prove that, they should be able to get recruits just as well as anybody else. But
those teams also have better players. So
exactly. It's all part of it. But why not try, if you're Larry Scott, to make that happen? Because that's an easy way to get some relevance, to gain some relevance. Because you're in the mix every year. Now, look, this year it would have been 8-seeded Oregon going to Tuscaloosa to play Alabama, and they would have gotten destroyed. But
would have watched it.
I'm not sure that's the same. You absolutely would have watched it. And it would have watched the hell out of the Pac-12 championship game.
Yeah.
And like USC or Oregon's going to make the playoff.
I was watching Christmas movies during that game. That wasn't my doing.
And you're Jewish.
Exactly. But hey, man, we can still enjoy the seasons. Come on.
That's exactly right. Listen, Holiday, quality Netflix Christmas flick that just came out. So.
Oh, I need to watch that. I haven't seen that.
But it's tremendous.
It was
not for the kids, by the way, not for the kids.
But if that were a playoff determining spot, to your point, though, I wouldn't have been watching Christmas movies.
Exactly. Exactly.
And SC was undefeated at that time.
Well, you thought they belonged in the playoff.
I thought they belonged in the discussion to potentially make it.
Well, I think that is something that the Pac-12 really needs to get on as a priority, as a conference priority, because that can help a lot without actually having to do anything difficult in recruiting. I mean, because saying recruit better is really hard. Like, it's easy to say, it's hard to do. Oregon is doing it. USC sometimes does it, but it's very difficult.
Can I ask you a question? It's kind of related to this, but absolutely, it's also like a Dear Andy show. So Dear Andy, I've got a question.
Okay.
What do you think is the, so it's really awesome to be a Clemson, Georgia, Ohio State, Alabama, Oklahoma, and LSU fan. But for the vast majority of the sports audience, their team, whether they want to admit it or not, don't have a chance to win. And the question that I receive in the recruiting mailbags all the time is, what can be done in the sport from a competitive standpoint or a competitive balance standpoint to even out the recruiting numbers a little bit? Whereas
nothing.
50%, well, wait. 50% of the top 100 players in the country this year signed at four or five programs. Do you think a scholarship reduction is a rational thought? To take it from 85 to 75 or 78, to reduce it by 7 or 8 players per class, to spread good players out more. I don't know that I like that, because it takes opportunities away from the high school athletes that deserve them.
That's the problem. The optics of it are bad. You're taking scholarships away from players, and there's a health and safety aspect of it too. How thin do you want rosters to be?
Yeah, I think you could make the argument, though, that the top six programs in the country have an abundance of depth, whereas
they do.
Whereas, like, we're talking about Division One starters sitting on the bench for 2 or 3 years that might be the missing link at a Cincinnati, or might be the missing link at a place that is on the cusp. Maybe Iowa State has a defensive back who's sitting on Alabama's bench right now. You know,
again, here's maybe where the NIL stuff might help a little bit, because if you can be the big dog at a Power Five school or sit for 2 years at Alabama, maybe you go be the big dog. I don't think everybody's going to do that, because from a financial standpoint, it's nice to make a few thousand dollars.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
But if you do what you're supposed to do at Alabama,
the real payday is coming.
Figures as a signing bonus. Yeah. So it's not going to compare.
And there is a lot of short-sightedness, though, Andy. A lot of parents and a lot of athletes will look at $3,000
It might shear a few of them off, and that might tilt the back. And you mentioned SMU. I'll mention SMU even further. Back when their boosters were paying people under the table, they were really good at football.
Yeah.
So you make that opportunity legal. Well, legal is the wrong word. None of it was ever actually illegal, but you make it within the NCAA rules. You can do it. A program like that might flourish in that environment.
You drive around Dallas and you see billboards on the highways for each area of town. So if you're in Oak Cliff or Plano or Dallas proper or DeSoto, a player that's on SMU's roster is prominently displayed on the billboard. And those are paid by SMU as a recruiting tactic. But you don't think that Preston Stone, the local fringe five-star quarterback who's going to SMU, is going to be somebody who could profit from name, image, and likeness at SMU? And the other thing—
He's at least getting a trade with a Ford dealership for an F-150.
And the other thing, too, is you can go to smaller schools in the new system— and if things don't work out or you're too good after 2 years, you can transfer very easily to a program that'll take you immediately. And like if Preston Stone goes to – and I'm just using him as an example. But if he goes to SMU like he is, he signed, and he's an awesome quarterback for a few years. You know, is the fun SMU offense that everybody loves to watch. And then at the end of his career, he's like, you know what? It stinks being in the group of five. I want to go play in the playoff. You don't think Oklahoma would take him or LSU would take him? And I think there's like a major argument, and going even back to question one, of how these quarterbacks can take bigger, better, different risks coming out of high school than they used to. And when you add NIL into it, you know, it's possible that some of these smaller schools that don't have a chance to compete at the highest level might actually have a sales pitch. Now, I don't know that I think that the hierarchy of the sport's going to change as a result of it. I think the most seasoned recruits and their parents understand that taking a Ford F-150 to go to a school that isn't as equipped to develop you into an NFL player is a short-sighted and frankly dumb decision, because a car that's worth $40,000 in the grand scheme of things will probably be worth $12,000 by the time they're out of college. And then they might not get the NFL contract that they were going to get. But
it drops by $12,000 right when you drive it
off
the lot.
Unless it's a Raptor. So.
It still does. It still drops by more than that when you drive it off the lot.
Yeah.
But anywho, you're right. There are a lot of dynamics to this that I don't think people have thought through, and in both directions. But I do think that might help shear a couple. I don't think it's going to keep the bulk of people from signing with the Alabamas and the Ohio States and the Clemsons, but I do think it's going to shear a couple of them off. We'll be right back after this message from one of our lovely sponsors. Let's go to our last question. You got a good list for this one. This is from Zachary. What non-conference game should fans be most excited for next season, assuming everything is back to normal? And I realize it's a big assumption, but let's indulge and assume that some people can show up and watch these things, and they're going to get played when they're supposed to get played. Pick your own criteria: on-field play, rivalries, off-field drama, etc. What are the ones you're most excited about, Ari?
The one I'm most excited about is Georgia-Clemson, because I think that's the game that has the most impact on the playoff, but also is the two best teams playing each other. And maybe you could say Ohio State-Oregon, depending on what Oregon is next year, might have an impact as well. I mean, all these games, but let's just list them first. Alabama-Miami, Georgia-Clemson, Ohio State-Oregon, Washington-Michigan, Notre Dame-Cincinnati. And I think Notre Dame's playing Indiana too. So either Notre Dame's playing Indiana or Cincinnati's playing Indiana. But I just like the thing that I want to see is that Georgia-Clemson game. Is Georgia going to take that step forward and go from the team that everybody says goes 10-2 and actually look like the most talented team in college football? And are they going to get a chance right out of the gate with a five-star quarterback to potentially be what everybody thought they were going to be? Or is Clemson just going to resume what they are? Like, to me, that is the game of the year.
Yeah, I can't wait, because it felt like Georgia got the quarterback situation right finally at the end of the year with JT Daniels. And what happens if he has a full offseason with that offense? And they get a lot of guys back. You know, Georgia didn't have a ton of guys say, I'm leaving for the NFL. They had a few guys take advantage of the opportunity to come back. They've recruited really well. I just think this is a chance for Georgia to establish themselves as the national title contender they're supposed to be. And you have to do it by beating Clemson. You got to earn it.
Georgia is such an interesting case study to me, because I just like tweeted the other day, Georgia is going to be legit. And everybody's like, no, they're not. They just suck. It doesn't matter. They always suck. They never reach their potential. And it's just like, this team has enough coming into next year to win the national championship if things go the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. And they've had enough the last few years, with the exception of the quarterback position. So they can jump right into that, because we don't know what Alabama is going to look like. We've seen DJ Uiagalelei play at Clemson, so we got a pretty good idea that they're still going to be really good. Ohio State's in flux with the quarterback. You look in Georgia's division, Kyle Trask and Kyle Pitts are gone from Florida, so that game becomes easier for them than it probably would have been. I actually think Emory Jones is going to do all right at Florida at quarterback, but I feel like Georgia still has the talent advantage in that series. So, it's going to be a fascinating season with them coming in with a guy they feel like is the answer at quarterback.
Let me just correct one thing I said that was wrong. Indiana plays Cincinnati, not Notre Dame. I got them mixed up. That's going to be a good game, but all of Notre Dame's games are non-conference. So Indiana plays Cincinnati. I think that could be interesting. But let me go back to the Georgia-Clemson game for a second. Clemson is also – that's a big game for them too. Because if you go get blown out by Ohio State in the playoff and then turn around and lose your opener the next year, then that puts you behind the eight ball right out of the gate of making the playoff. Now, I do think that if they ended up losing to Georgia and Georgia achieves what we think they can, then they still could be a one-loss ACC champion that makes the playoff. But from a program hierarchy standpoint, Clemson is on the brink of what happened to Ohio State after the 15 season, where you lose a game in the playoff, or you don't make the playoff, and then a blowout in 2016, and then 17-18 you don't make it, then you fall way back into that hierarchy. And like, I don't think that Clemson's in that position, because they've got DJ and their recruiting is pretty great. But at the same time too, it's just like losing two games in a row or a place like that, even over the course of two seasons, is kind of a tough thing to be in. So that's a huge game for them as well.
I also like the Alabama-Miami one. Just, we'll see if Derek King, I'm assuming he can get healthy by the season opener. He tore his ACL in the bowl game. But Miami, again, kind of flopping at the end of a season. The North Carolina game was a disaster. So can they finally turn that ship around? And we'll see them against an elite program right off the bat. I don't know what Alabama is going to be, but it's always exciting to see how Alabama reloads. And I think defensively Alabama is going to be nasty, especially up front. They're losing Christian Barmore, but Tim Smith is there. Will Anderson off the edge. I mean, they could have a truly elite pass rush as Will Anderson develops and gets better. So this is going to be fun to watch. I'm so excited to think about what might be I don't even know if it's going to be normal, Ari. I have no idea what life in America is going to be like in 9 months. But got vaccines being rolled out. It seems like, and also I think just having gone through this year, the schools understand a little bit better how to put things in place to have spring practice, to be in a position to play the season when it's ready to be played. So I hope that happens. I hope it's normal by September. I don't know if it will be or not, but I do feel pretty confident at this point that the season will start on time and we won't have the same kind of hand-wringing that there was last summer. So that'll be nice. But all right, we have to get to the truly controversial part of this podcast. We haven't done a random ranking in a while. It's time. Zachary, who asked the question about the non-conference games, has a great topic: fast food breakfast dishes. your top five fast food breakfast dishes. You have put in your 10,000 hours on this topic, as have I. Ari, what is your number five?
We have to start with some preamble here, always with me, because I'm a psychopath.
Okay. Absolutely.
Just so everybody knows, my breakfast sandwich, my perfect breakfast sandwich, has no meat on it. And I know that that's sacrilegious to some people, but I think there's nothing.
Is it a sandwich if it doesn't have meat, or is it just bread?
I like egg and cheese only on my breakfast sandwiches.
Egg is meat.
Okay, if that counts as meat, I'm just saying I don't have sausage and bacon on
my... Egg is meat. Yes, egg is animal protein. It is meat.
Okay, all right, but it's not the meat that I'm talking about, which is bacon and sausage. I like the way those two things taste, but I don't want it to overpower my bread that I go...
No, that's understandable. That's understandable.
No, but some people be like, what the hell are you talking about? You can't have a breakfast sandwich without bacon on it. And like, trust me, Bill Landis, I know. And some people think that the sausage and the bacon is the amazing part of the thing. I like leave it off completely. So we did dishes only and not fast food menus for breakfast, which I think once we're done with the rankings, you'll know what my favorite breakfast is. And it's very controversial and people lose their mind when I tell them, but there is one clear favorite for fast food breakfast, which we'll get to. But my number five is the Jack in the Box Supreme croissant sandwich. I think, you know, the croissant is my favorite breakfast bread, and not all the places, including McDonald's, have the croissant as part of the bread. And I think Jack in the Box does a very good job with their breakfast sandwich. And the best thing about it is that unlike some of the other places, and I'm not name dropping McDonald's, I'm name dropping my number one pick. They don't serve it all day. So the fact that you can go in anytime I go to Jack in the Box day or night, I get that sandwich because I think it's delicious and I get it with egg and cheese only on it.
I'm going to go with the classic McDonald's Egg McMuffin. English muffin, circular egg, cheese. How do you beat that?
It's not even the best sandwich on its own menu.
Perfect package. It's just good. I don't like McDonald's biscuits. So, and I really don't like McGriddles. I don't do the sweet savory thing at breakfast. Give me savory, savory, savory. So no McGriddles for me. Egg McMuffins are fantastic. If you're in a place that isn't the South, because I don't necessarily trust the chains that exist in the South, that when I'm not in the South, I don't know that those people know how to make biscuits. So I think I can always rely on an Egg McMuffin.
I think that Egg McMuffin is like the Ritz cracker of breakfast. It's kind of just the thing that's consistent and everybody gets it, but it did not make my list because I don't think it's the best sandwich on its own menu. And I have one question because I might need to sub out something of my list.
Okay.
Is Tudor's on your list or does that not count?
That doesn't count. Tudor's is too regional. For those who don't know, who've never had the pleasure, Tudor's Biscuit World is a chain that started in West Virginia. They have locations all over West Virginia. I believe they're also in Pennsylvania. I think there's some in Maryland. It is tremendous. They have these unbelievable, huge biscuit sandwiches. I recommend the Huggy Bear or the Mountaineer. They're so good. But no, we need more national type chains.
The reason why I asked you is because I didn't want you to get to number one and then hit me with that and then me leave it off the list because it is delicious.
My number two is a regional chain, but the region has expanded so much in the last 5 years that it's getting more closer to national.
But I just wanted to make sure that I gave Tudor's the respect that it deserves.
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah.
My number four is the McGriddle. It is, and I get it with egg and cheese only. And I think it's delicious. And I'm not a sweet and savory person either, but I don't think that it's overpoweringly sweet. I just think it's the syrup in it, or the small amount of syrup in it, gives the bun a soft, flavorful taste. And I like McDonald's.
I also hate wet bread.
The full,
and it's basically a sandwich designed around wet bread.
So you're not a big roast beef au jus guy, huh? You don't want
if the bread is hearty enough, then it's fine. But also with the roast beef au jus, you are dipping it in the au jus and then eating it immediately. So your bread doesn't have time to get soggy and mushy. The McGriddle is made that way, and
the McGriddle's amazing, and I'm not going to take any disparaging of the McGriddle. Everybody loves
McGriddle.
The McGriddle
slander here.
I'll log off this thing right now, dude. but I think it's the best sandwich on McDonald's menu. So that's why the McMuffin didn't make my list. I like McMuffins, and my buddy Bill Landis, who I've gone on many road trips with, will live and die by the sausage muffin that they have, which is mm-hmm. cheese, sausage, and on the McMuffin yep. muffin, which I think is great. Not top five.
I go back and forth between the sausage and the egg one.
I find the yolk in the egg McMuffin to be kind of gross.
Oh, see, I like it. I'm good with that.
Yeah.
All right. My next one is the Sonic Breakfast Toaster, which is egg, bacon, and cheese on Texas toast. There's very little in the world that can't be improved by putting it on Texas toast. And this is a prime example.
I have never had that. So I'm going to, you know, God, I hate dieting. It's the worst thing in the world.
Now you just want to go out to the Sonic right now, don't you?
Yeah. Well, there's one thing that I'm sure is going to be really high on your list, and we're going to have that argument when we get to it. But that sounds great. Texas toast is amazing. I love all sorts of bread. I just happen to be partial to the croissant. My number three is Burger King's hash browns. And I don't know if you've had them before, but they're the little circular hash browns.
Then yeah, they're pretty good.
I get two larges when I go there. And they are my favorite. They're salty, they're crunchy, they're flavorful, and there is an abundance of them. And I like dipping them in ketchup, and sometimes even when I'm feeling kind of froggy, I can put them on the sandwich and open the sandwich that I'm having. Because I think like that
Permani Burger King Brothers.
Yeah, except this one has flavor. Permani's is terrible. But the concept of Permani's is genius. But I love the Burger King hash browns at my number three.
My number three also comes from Burger King. It is the bacon, egg, and cheese croissant sandwich. I, like you, do enjoy a croissant. I like bacon with my egg and cheese, though. So I want mm-hmm. it all in that nice little package and that flaky croissant. Give me the bacon, egg, and cheese croissant sandwich at number three.
My number two is the McDonald's hash brown. The singular hash brown.
I'm glad. I was worried when you said the Burger King hash brown at three. I was like, I wonder if he's... thinks they're better than McDonald's hash browns, because they're definitely not.
I mean, they taste similar to me, and there's more of them. And the reason why I almost flipped them is because McDonald's hash brown is gone before you can enjoy it. So unless you're a savage and order five of them, I never feel like I can enjoy them to their full potential.
I've never done that, Ari. I can't imagine what that would be like.
Have you done that?
I've never done five. I've done two or three.
Yeah, I think you need three to really get the potato aspect to it. So I think the fresh ones are great. But they're just not big enough.
You get one that's been under the heater for a while, that does not go well. But yeah. if you get the one that just came out of the fryer, yeah. It's so good.
And number two on my breakfast, I mean, that is a high ranking.
Yeah.
And one point I wanted to make that I didn't make earlier on, the McGriddle folded egg is better than the egg they put on. I just wanted to make sure that I was clear what people are screaming.
You don't like the circular egg McMuffin. The egg that has the yolk kind of floating in it. Yeah.
The egg that they use on the McGriddle, I think, is more appetizing
The egg McMuffin egg freaks people out.
Yeah.
And I understand that, but I have no problem with it. So
okay, you're two.
All right. My number two is the Bojangles Cajun Filet Biscuit. It is, if you hit a Bojangles, and Bojangles is a chain that started in the Carolinas, but recently it has expanded quite far. I believe they might have them out your way in Dallas now, Ari. But they're trying to go national. They serve biscuits all day. They're a fried chicken restaurant normally when they're not serving the biscuits. But their breakfast is fantastic. Their iced tea is amazing. But the Bojangles Cajun Filet is a spicy chicken filet biscuit. Now, Bojangles can be very hit or miss on the biscuits, depending on the location.
I was about to tell you.
It's who's working there that day. Because if you get a great biscuit at Bojangles, it is unbelievable. But there are some people that will just leave them in there too long and they'll be burned. And you had that situation at your first try.
With you, I said, Andy, I'm going to Bojangles. What did you tell me to get? I got the biscuit. It was so dry, I couldn't even finish it.
Yeah. And if you get the wrong person, that's what happens. And they need to work on their quality control. Now, I wish that their chicken filet was as good as the Chick-fil-A chicken biscuit chicken filet. But Chick-fil-A's biscuits are just weird. They're just wrong. They don't taste right. There's something off about the texture. If Chick-fil-A had a better biscuit, they'd be number one, no question. But that biscuit is just so odd. The Bojangles Cajun filet is the second best of the chicken filets in a biscuit. And when you get a good Bojangles biscuit, it's just heaven.
I'm going to say something that is going to explode the world now. Chicken is not a breakfast meat.
Except when you're eating the unborn embryos of them?
Yeah. Egg? I'm not biblical. I don't know how or how you want to talk about it. I just know
is
that
it an embryo?
Fried.
It's unfertilized.
I don't know what it is. All I know is...
I'm probably using the wrong term there.
Yeah. All I know is fried chicken is not what... It tastes amazing. And if you wanted to put a chicken biscuit on lunch or dinner, I'm ready to listen. But it doesn't equate to me for breakfast.
Stop making so many rules. If it's delicious, eat it.
Oh, yeah, I know. Well, then I would have pizza at 8 a.m. like I do sometimes.
What's wrong with that?
There isn't. I'm just saying when I think about breakfast and I'm like, what is really good? The best breakfast I've ever had in my entire life, I went on a ski trip with my friend and I picked him up in Manhattan with my car. So don't ask me why, but he brought me a fresh New York everything bagel with butter, egg, and cheese on it. And it was the most delicious.
The everything bagel is a lie because it doesn't have cayenne pepper.
It was the best.
If it had everything, it would have cayenne pepper. and Cam Molina, our producer, he reminds us the yolk in the egg is the food source for the embryo when it does get fertilized. So
these are the answers.
That's
that we
why
needed.
It has all the protein.
Thanks, Cam.
Yes, that is excellent. You don't make those rules. So question: do you not like breakfast for lunch or breakfast for dinner? Because
see,
those are amazing.
Now you're going to start putting me in a headlock because I eat breakfast. I'll have a breakfast sandwich I'll order a McGriddle at McDonald's at 3 p.m.
So what's wrong with breakfast for breakfast?
But if you said best fast food sandwiches, I wouldn't list it. I would be consistent with my thinking. Like I would put like the Chick-fil-A spicy chicken sandwich on the best lunch and dinner, but I wouldn't put it on my breakfast even if it's available. Like
are a bundle of contradictions.
Yeah.
You're just a Gordian knot of contradictions.
I just don't want to order fried chicken for breakfast when I can have a really good egg sandwich because that's breakfast to me.
Dude, I would just order fried and had fried chicken for breakfast. Just straight up
it's
breakfast.
Like, what
now,
if
I don't
we just did a random ranking?
Because the fasting, but...
What if we did the random ranking though, Andy, and you're like, okay, five favorite breakfast items. And I was like, pot roast, grilled steak, and just like,
I think that would be on brand for you.
All right, you ready for my number one?
I'm ready.
Burger King croissant, egg and cheese only, fresh steamed bun. Their egg is the best fast food egg. Their cheese, the hash browns, Burger King's orange juice in a carton you get. Burger King has the best fast food breakfast out there. And
wow,
I almost,
that's a hot take.
I know, and people go crazy. So when you said best fast food breakfast, I was like, oh God, this is going to go nuts. People are going to go nuts. But I think that Burger King is the worst fast food chain when it comes to like lunch and dinner items. I think it is by far the best when it comes to breakfast. I would pick Burger King. I've had Bill will go to McDonald's and he'll go get his sausage biscuit and the hash brown at McDonald's, and he'll pull into Burger King so I can get my meal when we're on the road together. It is my favorite.
That is a good coworker right there. Bill Landis, you are a fine, fine American. All right, my number one, and I had this just the other day when I was coming back from the national championship game. I was driving home. So for those who don't know, and you haven't been listening for the podcast very long, if you don't, I do intermittent fasting, so I only eat for an eight-hour period each day. So the day of the national championship game, I stopped eating at 5:30 p.m., which meant I could eat at 9:30 a.m. the next morning because I was driving. I had to leave very early to drive home, and so I wanted to be able to eat some food on my drive. Did not want to make the entire drive without eating. So I stopped in Ocoee, Florida, and I got a Hardee's steak biscuit, or more specifically, I got two Hardee's steak biscuits and two plain biscuits. And
you're a god.
The Hardee's steak biscuit is the best breakfast biscuit there is. Where Hardee's is Carl's Jr., I don't know why it has to be different, but it is. But where Hardee's is Carl's Jr., they are now making these biscuits. You can get them. I don't know if they do the country fried steak one out in California. I hope they do, because it will inspire the Californians to change their eating habits away from the tofu and the bean sprouts. This is a tremendous biscuit. It's a country fried steak biscuit. I've been eating it since I was a kid. When we go to my grandma's house in Selma, Alabama, I'd get a bunch of them there. But I mean, we'd get them when we were at home living in Orlando. We'd get them there too. They're just, the biscuits at Hardee's are the most consistent fast food biscuits. They're the best fast food biscuits day to day, location to location. You can almost always get a perfect biscuit at Hardee's. And so you get that, and then you do the steak, the country fried steak. It just, it's the perfect
country fried salt steak
to, yeah,
it's so good.
It's a big, thick, juicy, salty. It's really good. Now, they do one now, pork chop and gravy biscuit. It's really good. It may be a bit much even for me, but it's good. But when I'm just craving that feeling of when I was a kid and getting this the best breakfast ever, I want the Hardee's steak biscuit.
Yeah, I think it's blasphemous that you didn't have the McDonald's hash brown on your list, because it's like, I think, universally the number
it's
one thing.
It's a side dish.
It's an item.
You give me a choice between a McDonald's hash brown or a biscuit from Hardee's or Bojangles. Give me more biscuits.
Well, I put sides on my thing.
I know. It's your choice. I think sides are great. And actually, like, if we're talking Chick-fil-A, I get two orders of waffle fries and one sandwich when I'm at lunch. But I don't think that hash browns are in the same pantheon as French fries. So I'm not going to give up the chance to eat more biscuit to eat more hash browns.
When I return to eating like an animal, but more sensibly,
never.
There are two things I want to try. I heard Wendy's breakfast is legit now, like, because they just renovated their entire thing, or they like redid their entire menu.
It does look very interesting.
I haven't had commercials. But it does. Yeah. I heard it's super good, so I'd like to try, because I love fast food breakfast. And two, I don't think that we know this, but I think Arby's has an egg croissant sandwich, and you would never think to go to Arby's for breakfast. But somebody texted me about it.
Put the roast beef on the egg.
I'm gonna Google croissant. It right now.
I know Arby's, you don't want that. You just want the egg, but I want the roast beef on it too.
Yeah, no, egg and cheese only. Arby's breakfast. Yeah, they have biscuits, and they have croissants, and they have the potato cakes. But you can get those even with your actual dinner too. I've had them right there too. So there's places, and it's funny.
You're not giving up curly fries for those, are you?
I think I like a potato pancake. You know, it might be my heritage. But the
Arby's has curly fries, Arby. Arby.
You can start calling me Arby. I think curly fries, and maybe, I don't know if we've ever done this, but random ranking of fries, shoestring, tater tots, and like just did potatoes. Arby's, curly fries would be at the lower part of mine. So, you know, I'm happy that we're different.
I don't think we can be friends anymore.
I think it's funny that we didn't say Dunkin' Donuts or any of the other places like that, but I think that McDonald's and Burger King are all you need in this world for fast food.
Yeah,
breakfast.
I mean, Dunkin' makes great coffee, and I know people who, that's not good coffee. No. Compared to gas station coffee, it's fantastic, and that is what I'm comparing it to, because you can go pay $3.50 for a cup of drip coffee if you'd like. I find that to be stupid. So I will take the Dunkin' coffee or a giant cup of iced coffee. That's great.
I'm not a coffee person. I don't drink it. It's not that I just don't like it. It's just I never got into a habit of it, so it's never been a part of my routine. But I heard that McDonald's has actually like legit coffee. Like they are.
I'm afraid of getting burned. Have you ever watched the documentary on that lawsuit, the lady who sued McDonald's?
Because she got burned on the coffee, yeah.
Everybody thinks it's the most frivolous lawsuit ever. Go watch that documentary. You will not think so.
Was it like scalding hot?
Yes, and like scientifically determined to be at that temperature, because it takes X number of minutes for most people to get to the wherever they're going, where they will then drink the coffee.
The thing I hate the most about coffee.
You won't think it's frivolous anymore.
I don't like coffee, and I don't like tea. Not that I don't like the way they taste, but I don't go for it. But the reason why is every single time I do get it, it's so hot, I can't even enjoy it. Like, give it to the customer at a reasonable temperature for them to put it in their mouth. Every time I get coffee or tea, I burn my tongue. And it kind of takes...
You're never going to make any money in the fast food business thinking that way.
Yeah, but I just think that Burger King, if you haven't had it, if you hate, I'm so sorry. Egg and cheese, here's the order. egg and cheese croissant meal with the largest hash brown and another egg and cheese croissant on the side. And if you're really hungry, a small hash brown to go with it. Two meals. I mean, I don't know what could go wrong with your weight if you did it that way, but there's nothing better than waking up in time to do that at 10:30. And especially when you're on the road or you're on the way somewhere on a road trip, there's nothing better to me.
I'll give you the order. A hearty steak biscuit, a Bloody Mary, and a hearty steak biscuit.
Yeah, I mean,
put it on the Underhills.
Is it the deep fried country steak?
Of course.
I've never had that, and my mouth is foaming.
There you
because
go.
I like well, country you, fried
you,
steak.
You probably find one near you if you were allowed to eat it.
Did you know that Dallas is the best fast food city in America?
I would imagine because it's in the middle, basically.
It's in the middle, so it's got so both many
people,
sides.
So many people travel through. You have Whataburger.
I mean, you have everything. You've got Jack in the Box. You've got Whataburger. You've got Brahms. You've got In-N-Out. You've got all these awesome taco places that don't exist anywhere else. You've got it's literally has everything. It doesn't have Bojangles, but it has every.
But it will. It has one of my favorite Florida-based chains, Pollo Tropical.
Oh, they have that here?
They do. They have Pollo Tropical in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
I got to Google that. I've never seen it. But they also have like Golden Chick and Chicken Express and like other like fried chicken chains I've never heard of before. I don't think that there's a better fast food city in America.
Well, and it's interesting because you just moved from Columbus, which is America's test market.
I know, which I like.
It's where every chain test markets is. You guys got the Chick-fil-A sweet potato fries. Nobody else got those.
I don't know that I lived there for 10 years, and I don't know that I ever really got to experiment as much as I would. I don't ever recall hearing when those things are happening, so I don't see it.
They never told you guys because you were the guinea pigs. They didn't want you to know.
Trust me, dude. I went through my fair share of fast food lines when I lived in Columbus, and I never saw weird things. Like, I think they were the first one to do the McDonald's chicken and waffle sandwich, and I think I had that. But other than that, I don't really ever recall some of the crazy stuff that they used to do there. But Columbus, Ohio is the perfect place
It is America's test market.
Yeah. 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 I'm so hungry. God, every single time I do this podcast with you, man. All right.
I'm going to let you go and hopefully you're allowed to eat something and hopefully it's somewhat satisfying. Go get a McGriddles. Get some wet bread. It'll make you feel better.
Yeah. McGriddle with no bun, right? And just eat the egg, folded egg. Cause it's like, there's no carbs, you know?
There you go. Now you're thinking. All right, thank you so much for listening. Hope you had some fun with this one. We will talk to you again very soon.